We'll only build one now. There was only one Mars Observer. Well, I flew right past the planet. That didn't work out. But at least we had the two Viking. Think of the Viking machines that landed on Mars in 76. 1976. And they were very successful. They had RTGs on board, radioisotope, thermoelectric generators. They operated for years on Mars. They couldn't go anywhere. They had three landing legs, not four, but no wheels. And they had a seismograph on it. They a seismometer. They had one, but it stayed on the vehicle itself. They didn't have a way to, well, they decided not to put one on the surface. Let me drop it. And the Viking missions, they left it attached to the vehicle, and they said they had the equivalent of, they called it noise. So in other words, any kind of movement or anything that was going on in the spacecraft would activate the earthquake detector. But the one that they have now on InSight, put it on the surface. So this way, if a meteor or something hits on the other side of the planet, you're going to have these P waves and S waves traveling through the surface of the ground, and then this is going to pick it up. And by comparing the time of arrival of these different noises or vibrations, they're going to be able to tell what's inside or how deep the mantle goes into the surface of Mars. So, and the article, you'll have to read the article to find out which ones are funded, which ones aren't. You know, there's been so many that have gone away, like the ARM mission. Let me drop it. Now, you read all of this stuff for a couple of years, they're planning on this, planning on that. The ARM was the asteroid redirect mission. We were going to send the basic robotic spacecraft out to grab an asteroid and bring it back and push it around the moon, have it go into orbit around the moon, and then at some point send a crew on a space launch system in an Orion spacecraft out to the orbit of the moon, dock with this asteroid that we put there with a robotic piece of equipment, do an EVA, go out, take a couple of pieces, bring it back inside, bring those pieces back to Earth. And they canceled that. You know, they canceled so many missions. So a lot of global warming type of spacecraft that have been canceled recently. So it'd be nice to find out if all or even half the ones that are in that magazine go through. I hope they do. European Space Agency usually pretty good. Design these things and they think nothing of, you know, whatever it costs, they put it on the Ariane 5 rocket, launch it from South America, from French Guiana, and off it goes. And they have a planned mission to Mercury coming up probably later this year, maybe as late as, I think it's late this year, but it could go off next year, early in the year. But it's called Colombo Bepi. I wonder if that's listed. Colombo Bepi. It's supposed to be an orbital mission around Mercury. Did they mention that one?
I think they did not mention that, Paul, because the article is oriented toward exoplanet research and looking for life. So when it comes to studying the objects within our solar system, that wasn't the main thrust of this particular article, so most likely that was not mentioned. They did mention, though, that James Webb, which has got a huge mirror, that if it gets properly focused, will have extremely high infrared resolution. We haven't had high-resolution infrared, that combination of infrared, which can penetrate lots of clouds and can look at an awful lot of the spectral lines that fall in the infrared, which are going to give us evidence of light and of life and atmospheres and so on. if that works half as well as its capability, it's going to make some very interesting discoveries. So I'm sure hoping that James Webb makes it, because it's, I think, the most difficult mission they've ever attempted as far as location, size, and the amount of things that have to be deployed just right for the whole thing to work. There was another comment I was going to make about what you were talking about. European Space Agency, yes, they're going to be doing quite a few things that we don't have the funding to do. I sure hope that President Trump doesn't cancel some of these funding things. To your knowledge, is the NASA budget this year and next year holding fast to the previous years of all address 2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, they've been holding around $18 billion for the last, I guess, 5 years. And they went up recently a couple of years ago. And then this year, it just went up. I think it's around $19.1 billion, I think. But they did say originally, 6 months ago, they were going to cut back. Now, I just read they were going to go up a little bit, but... You know, yeah, they're hanging out about the same. There's not a big change. So they're underfunded for a lot of these things that are on the drawing board. Did they mention W first with the coronagraph mission in the March issue of Scientific American? Because I'm curious if they mentioned that. That has been canceled, W first mission.
I don't remember seeing that name, Paul, so since it's a canceled mission already, and the article is talking about all the things that are currently in production, ready to be launched, have already been launched, or about to look for funding, that was what the thrust of the article was. So things that have already been canceled, I don't think the article mentioned those, or at least not very many of them, Paul.
Yeah, this one had, you know, I mean, it had legs on it. They probably put a small portion into it already, and it was going to need $3 billion. They don't want to fund it. It's the size of Hubble, but it would have the clarity of Hubble, but it would cover 100 times the sky as Hubble. It had a much wider field of view. They got it dirt cheap because the mirrors were already built. In fact, there's two mirrors. They wound up with one of them. The reason they were extra is they were part of the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, which, you know, one of the things that they do is they launch satellites, spy satellites, and, you know, just like we have the Hubble facing the stars. These were mirrors that were facing Earth, but they were planed a little bit, quite differently, for a wider view of the land. So, since they were extra, and they were already made, NRO said to NASA, here, take one of these. Okay, no problem. So they saved a large amount of money by doing that. And they were on their way to building W-1st. It would have been the next big project after James Webb Space Telescope, but officially that's gone now. Now, you never know. Let me drop it.
I'm going to make a guess.
Whatever they've built so far away, they'll store it somewhere. They put it in bubble wrap and then put it away. And sometimes they get resurrected years later. I'd like the Discover mission. Discover was the one that was put out by... Originally, it was going to be called Triana, and it was Al Gore's big favorite mission. It was going to be great. It was going to go out to the one position, look back at Earth, take pictures of Earth, all in. Next administration that got in there, Al Gore didn't make it. They canceled this thing. But NASA, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they put it in bubble wrap, put it in a back room somewhere. And all these years later... years ago, it was the Obama administration. They said, "Oh, let's take this thing out. This thing's half built already. Let's put it on a spacecraft." They put it on Falcon 9, which is an inexpensive spacecraft compared to anything that NASA launches. And they launched that same, it was called the Triana spacecraft. They changed the name to Discover, the Discover mission. Plus, but they added more stuff to it. Now, instead of just looking at the Earth all the time, taking pictures, it's now doing what the ACE spacecraft and some of the work that SOHO is doing. It's also looking at the sun. And it gives us an early warning system if there's some kind of a solar flare that's coming our way. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I'm doing a calculation right now as to what is the near-field range of the Hubble mirror. When Hubble was building their mirror, the news reports made it sound like they wanted a mirror a few inches bigger in diameter, so Hubble ground its own mirror and got themselves into trouble. That the Department of Defense had offered a couple of mirrors to the Hubble project, and the Hubble project turned them down. I think there's a very good reason they turned them down. There's a universal rule of thumb for mirrors and radio telescope antennas and so on. The near-field range, the closest range where you can get good focus, is 2D squared over lambda. You take the diameter of the Hubble mirror and apply the formula 2D squared over lambda and use optical frequencies. I think the nearest distance at which you can focus that thing is beyond the distance of the moon. The mirrors that were being offered were space-based mirrors that were looking down at the Earth, 200 miles away. And that's a very different mirror than one that can focus at infinity where Hubble wants to work. Let me drop it. And yes, you can add some extra correcting lenses to a mirror that's made for a 200-mile range and try to get it to infinity. But there's a sacrifice in doing that. You lose a little bit of resolution. As you know, the Hubble mirror was ground to the wrong shape, and it required corrective lenses. And the corrective lenses, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, gave you a 95% correction. But it wasn't a perfect correction because you're adding extra lenses and mirrors to correct for the wrong shape of the Hubble mirror. So what we now know, the corrective lenses they could have put on the Department of Defense offered mirror would have saved them some money, and they would have had almost the same performance. So that's a bunch of guesses on my part. One other thing I wanted to mention to you, Paul, let me drop. You talked about this seismometer that has the nearly perfect vacuum made out of a titanium. And seismic waves are, the majority of seismic waves, your P and S wave, are usually quite far subsonic. I'd sure like to believe that that seismic detector has enough frequency response that it can go into the optical frequencies so that it stands a chance of acting like a microphone. Without a doubt, when you put a spacecraft on something like Mars, the photographs you get are the most valuable things. I'd also like to have a microphone. I'd like to hear that wind whistling. I'd like to hear the sand being blasted against the strut of the spacecraft, and you hear the sound of that. So if that seismometer has enough frequency response, it could be a poor man's microphone. I bet you they haven't mentioned anything along those lines, have they, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, you don't like this. They've tried it before, but it never worked out. This one's got two microphones, one for coming through the atmosphere, and so I'm listening to everything that goes on there. And then another one on the spacecraft itself. Correction. I'm thinking of the 2020. I'm thinking of the 2020 relevant, not this one. This one's not got the microphone. That's the 2020 rover coming up. That is similar in size to Curiosity. That's got two microphones on board. Yeah, no, this one doesn't have it. What this one has is two suitcase size satellites. As it's coming to Mars, getting near Mars, they're going to be released from the cruise vehicle. And it's going to be doing communications and pictures and stuff that, they're like CubeSats. And That's the special thing they're going to have with InSight. I forget the name. They have these satellite names for those two things that are going to separate from the spacecraft. But yeah, no microphones on this. I have to check. Don't think they're going to put a microphone on this one. I'm positive about the new rover. But yeah, that would be great. You're saying that the seismometer could act as a microphone?
Yes, I do, Paul. Even though it's buried in the ground, the majority of what it's going to hear is ground seismic waves. Still, if local sound is happening, wind whistling and sand beating against the strut, some of that with such sensitivity is going to be coupled through that soil into that seismometer. So it could be a poor man's microphone. I believe there were a number of attempts to put microphones on some of the landing spacecraft. I believe they all failed. By the way, if I didn't make a math error, the nearest that the Hubble Space Telescope, 2D squared of a lambda, that mirror that is 94 inches in diameter, the nearest it can give you a full resolution focus is 12,900 miles. So it could focus on the moon. I don't think they've taken the time to do it. But that's way beyond the altitude from an Earth orbit to look down at the surface. So if a Department of Defense mirror was being offered, and if it originally was ground intending to focus at the surface of the Earth, which makes the mirror elliptical in shape, not parabolic. And so that's a very different mirror, and I can see why they turned that down. But getting back to that seismometer, I think you're saying it's only going to go down a foot or two, which means it will hear, if the sensitivity you're describing, where it can measure something, the distance of a molecule or an atom or a nucleus of an atom, it will hear sound if it's got a high enough frequency response. And I guess you're saying they haven't said that so far. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, the lens was a wide, a wide field, and that's what they liked about it. So they were this was very acceptable to NASA and the science team. They were building this thing. They stopped the construction of it. So they were going to take that mirror. There's two mirrors like that. They're going to take the one, and they were going to adapt it to a telescope, a space telescope. So it was good to go. Funded. They already funded it for a couple of years ago, but now they stopped. So maybe they'll bring it back. So I'm not sure about the optics when you're talking about whether or not. How serious of a problem that would have been, but since I know it was accepted, whatever the shape was, NASA was happy with it at the time. So were the scientists, and then now they're not happy because the thing is now canceled. And as far as the seismometer goes, that's going to be sitting on the surface. In other words, it's a football-like thing. They're going to pick it up with an arm and just place it on the surface. That's as far as that one's going to go. It's not going to dig into the surface. The one that's digging into the surface is digging 15 feet down, and it's going to bring a thermometer down. Let's put it that way. It's going to bring a thermocouple of some sort all the way down with it, 15 feet down. That's the one that goes into the ground. The other thing, it's just going to sit on the surface.
Okay, getting back to the mirrors, when the Department of Defense offered the NASA project, the Hubble project, their available mirrors, which I'm going to call it a near-field focusing mirror, in those days they didn't yet have the experience of adding extra corrective lenses to make a near-field mirror into a far-field mirror. Now, by way of the error of the Hubble mirror and the correcting of it, NASA and their people have experience at building corrective lenses very successfully. Obviously, they resurrected Hubble from the depths of a failure, so to speak, where they're going to get very fuzzy pictures. And now they've gotten extremely good pictures. That's they're getting, I'm going to pick a number, 95% performance out of that mirror by way of the correction. As such, with that experience, I think they're now willing to accept near-field mirrors and do the correcting lenses adding to them. Because the process of grinding a mirror from scratch is an expensive, long-range project which can easily have errors, as you can tell. We're talking about surface accuracies of, I think, very small fractions of a millionth of an inch in order to get the lens to work right. And to maintain that accuracy across the whole darn shape, that's a good trick. Talk to somebody who has ground his own telescope mirror. Let me drop it. And you find out it's a very heroic effort. So, one of the probes is going to go down multiple feet with a thermocouple measuring temperature. And one of them is essentially sitting on the surface looking for S waves and P waves. I think you're saying the S and P waves are not going to be measured down multiple feet where the thermocouple is. I think it's not required. I think that the waves you would measure down there and the waves on the surface are fairly similar. So I see the possibility of this being our first microphone on Mars, Paul. Because up till now, I think we've had no successful microphone, although there may have been one or two attempts. Is that true? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they tried it before. I believe it was on the Phoenix mission. I don't think that worked out. So I'm not sure what went wrong with that one. Phoenix mission was, it looks like this particular design, you know what I mean? If you looked at the two of them together, you probably couldn't tell the difference unless you didn't know what you're looking for. But the Phoenix mission was the one that went up north, very, very far north on the north latitude on Mars, and dug into the ground with the, you know, had a nice robotic arm with a scoop on it, and they, you might remember the pictures, they dug down and, they found what looked like ice, sure enough, the next day through, not evaporation, essentially, it's bad point. It just disappeared. They had a picture of it, insulation, what do they call that? And then, they saw the white surface, and then they took a picture 24 hours later, and it was gone, you know. So it proved that there was ice there. The first conclusive proof. That was the Phoenix mission. Eventually it got covered up with carbon dioxide, frozen ice, quit working. It wasn't designed to work through a Martian winter. Back to you, Dick.
If this is the best of all worlds, Paul, what detectors would you like to see on a spacecraft going to, say, Mars? Microphone is one that I'd like to have. Not a high priority, but it adds icing on the cake. I think you had the equivalent of a microphone on Voyager because I think that's the method by which they measured the micrometeoroid impacts on the dish. There's particles on Voyager hitting the dish, and how big and how often, I think that was essentially a microphone. So the most long-range spacecraft we have ever issued had the equivalent of microphones. And yet, we haven't been able to put a microphone on Mars. An ordinary microphone that you and I set up for sound, to have it survive all the huge pressure changes of going into a hard vacuum and being blasted into space and all those vibrations and whatever, I can see how difficult it is to protect a microphone during the launch and landing and still have it recover all of its safety devices and then be able to hear small amounts of sound in a very thin atmosphere you've got on Mars. I can see how difficult that is. So what detection devices would you like to have on a spacecraft, Paul, if money was no object? WS2N, K2IW.
Microphones, without a doubt. I've been saying that forever. And then I like not only cameras, for instance, the Curiosity rover has 17 cameras on it, all different cameras. The new one going up is going to have 20,
I think 23 different cameras. So the 2020 rover. But I like to see where you could leave something behind and to take a picture of the rover, you know. And maybe, you know, with the arm, take the arm, put this thing on the surface, have the rover drive away, you know, a couple of meters, and then have this thing take a picture of the rover. Or, you know, not just, I mean, it's cool. That's the real reason I would like to do it. But you could take pictures of the wheels, if there's a problem with the wheels or a problem with the arm itself, like they have right now. The drill isn't working properly. Let me drop it. You know, and the drill normally, you know, has a gearing thing, a gearing motor, which pushes the drill bit into the rock. Well, that all failed, but now it took them months and months. They finally figured out that they could just bring the rover with the drill completely extended, not have any guides on it, just use the arm itself of the, you know, the robot arm itself to push into the rock to drill a hole. Well, you could have, you know, it took them months to figure out what the problem was. You know, they're checking the amperage on motors and this and that. If you had some kind of a little box, a little cube, like a cube set, you know, and you pick it up, put it on the surface with a camera on it, take a picture of whatever you're doing. Take a picture of the vehicle, take a picture of the bogey wheels that are operating, and, you know, make sure everything's going okay. That, to me, is great. And then you can always pick it up again with the arm and put it back on the bed of the rover and then drive off. And then if you need it again, do it again. That, to me, is cool. Back to you, Dick.
The current arm that's on Curiosity can be bent in all kinds of ways, I think. I think there's a camera on the tip of that arm. So therefore, that arm, I think, can be aimed at things like wheels to make measurements. And if you can put that arm in front of any of the other cameras, you can now take a picture of the tip of the arm. So does that arm not have enough maneuverability, enough of wrists and elbows and shoulders, to be able to do that? Is that what's going on here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it does. And they take like 17 pictures of the rover with the arm, you know. And then they'll splice them all together with computers on the ground, and they come up with what they call a selfie. But, you know, when I'm looking at their selfie, this thing has been stitched together seven different ways, and it looks like I'm drunk looking at it. It's just terrible pictures, and they think it's the greatest thing because they're able to do this, you know, 50 million miles away. But all you would need is some kind of a surface type of block, you know, with a camera in it. Pick it up, put it on the surface, and have this, you know, a motor on it where you can move it around if you want. Do anything you want. Take a picture of the rover itself, transmit it back on 70 centimeters back to the rover, transmit it back up to the MRO satellite, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter satellite, send it back to Earth, and you have a beautiful picture of the rover. One picture. You don't need 17 pictures stitched together, which come out looking terrible anyway. I think that would be a much better design. Plus the microphone.
So I think you're saying when they take a whole lot of pictures and stitch them together, they're not able to undistort the pictures to get rid of the barrel distortion, the pincushion distortion, and whatever. You would think you could remove those distortions from the pictures before stitching them together. Doesn't sound like they've spent enough time doing that distortion removal, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, it doesn't come out good. And it's, you know, it's like almost taking a picture of yourself in a mirror, standing on top of the mirror. You know, you would want to back away about 10 feet, 20 feet. Well, you could do that with a CubeSat, put it on the ground, drive away a little bit, have the thing take a picture, go back, pick it up again, put it back on the bed, drive away. And oh, next time, I don't think the funding there, but next time they do want to send a little helicopter up, and the design, it works, they tested it, but, you know, it's far from ready. I just don't think it's going to make it, not this time around. But that would be good. To, you know, if it crashes, though, what do? You can't go and fix a little box with a camera in it, you put it on a rock somewhere, and drive away, take beautiful pictures of your own rover. Yeah, there was nothing better than Apollo 12. When Apollo 12 went to the moon, and they landed 600 feet away from the Surveyor 3 lander that landed on the moon, and you had Pete Conrad and Alan Bean get out of the spacecraft, and they walked over to this thing and looked at it, evaluated it, took pictures of it, took the camera off of it, and brought things back. You know, that was terrific. You know, looking at a piece of equipment that was sent months earlier, and seeing how, or actually over a year earlier, seeing how it fared all that time. You know, that was really cool. Back then.
Because the atmosphere on Mars is roughly 0.7% of the atmospheric pressure you have on Earth, and the amount of mass of atmosphere is directly proportional to its air pressure. Double the atmospheric pressure, and you have twice the mass, pounds per cubic foot, so to speak, pounds per cubic meter. So 0.7% is a ratio of 143 to 1 lower. So if you and I built a quadcopter to work on Mars for the same size of the rotor blades and the same velocity, RPM of the rotor blades, you'd get 143 times less lift. So to run those rotors fast enough, to make the rotors big enough, to make a reliable quadcopter on Mars, to have enough energy in the batteries to run that thing for a reasonable length of time without wearing out and throwing itself apart, very similar to building an aircraft that's going to fly across Mars. That's not going to be built like the Gossamer Condor. I don't see this as a reliable operation, Paul. Looks good on paper, but you get into the specifics. There's so many degrees of difficulty, and there's so many methods of failure that it may not be worth the effort. You see what I'm getting at here? So little atmosphere is very difficult to live with any kind of air-breathing vehicle that's going to lift itself off the ground. WS2N, K2LAW.
They built this thing. I don't see it as the propeller on this thing. It's not a quadcopter. It's just a one big propeller. It's got to be about 2 feet long. Electric motor on top of the prop. You know, they have a solar panel that's going to pick up the sun, that's going to charge this thing, you know. And you got to hope, and they think they're going to fly this thing a minute or two per day, you know, every three or four, let it charge for 3 or 4 days. They got to probably go get it back, you know, it's not going to be able to land directly where they want it to land. The propeller's going to hit something similar way. It's not going to happen as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think they're 10 years away, maybe more, of doing something like that. But, I mean, that would be great if you could have this thing fly around. And what about the atmosphere, by the way? As far as noise with microphones, what do you think the noise situation would be? If you could have a rock fall or some kind of a noise on Mars, the microphone picking it up, in this thin atmosphere, what's that possibility? Would you be able to hear anything? I mean, not a vacuum, but it's close.
I am guessing you're going to get less sound. Your hidden portion of your question is, if I stand 10 feet away from the event and the sound gets weaker by the inverse square law, with a thin atmosphere, does the sound get weaker faster? There, I'm not sure, because the definition of temperature is how fast are the molecules moving. At room temperature, the molecules of air in your room are moving on average 500 meters per second. 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average speed of the molecules that are in the air molecules that are in the room with you right now, Paul. Let me drop the phone.
Come here, 211.
Joe recognized. So, if Mars was at the same temperature, those air molecules are moving at that same rate. There's not as many of them, but they're still conveying that sound. The speed of sound on Mars is going to be a little bit slower, not much, than the speed of sound on Earth because of the difference in temperature. So I think sound, with a sensitive microphone, I think there's a lot of sound to be heard because Mars occasionally gets wind speeds up to like 200 and some odd miles an hour, blowing the dust, creating dust storms that we've seen. So I'm convinced there's a lot of sound to listen to. WRYY, K2LAW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I was just watching a video on the Orion spacecraft on how they, when it comes back, what kind of parachutes this thing used. They said the parachutes take up the size of almost like a football field. They're like huge fields, floating down like 20 miles an hour in our atmosphere. How would something like that work on another planet like Mars where the atmosphere is incredibly thin?
I think Paul's going to bring to our attention the fact that the space crane that landed Curiosity started off with a parachute that was running at very high velocities. The parachute got it down to, I'm going to pick a number, 100 and some odd miles an hour. The rest of the deceleration for that landing procedure, I think, was done purely with rocket power. I don't think they could build a parachute strong enough, big enough, to bring it down to low velocities to land something as heavy as Curiosity on the surface of Mars. Is that approximately what happened to Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, they have these monster parachutes, but even the ones before that, you had the Pathfinder mission, you had Opportunity and Spirit. They came down and, you know, the parachute brought them down so far, and then they would cut it loose and had these big airbags that would pop out, surrounded the whole thing, and it would bounce for miles on the surface. And we're running out of time, but you remember that. they even couldn't do... There was Curiosity. I was bigger. It was a heavier thing, so they had to use the sky crane system. And it worked. They're going to use the sky crane system again for the 2020 rover. 73 Joe and Roy. And back to you, Dick. We're running out of time. K2RIWWS1.
Okay, what you've heard was Space Report number 290, Science and Physics Report number 20, TechNet Report number 1690. 73, you all, be kind to each other. Bye bye for now. And Paul, good job. Roy, real good job. You gave us a lot of curiosity things tonight, Roy. And I can tell the puzzle portion is a big attraction. I bet you'll be coming up with even more puzzles next week. AC2GS for any other comments, K2RIW.
Indeed, I already have a puzzle planned, and I hope to find some more over the next week. So, once again, mailbag@ac2gs.com or mailbag@limarktech.net. Send me your questions, send me your topics, send me what you're interested in. Thank you very much, Dick, and thank you very much, Paul.
I mean, that was in 75, so I was 12, and I remember not wanting to go in the water, and I'm a water rat, you know, I went in ever since I could, ever since I jumped off my father's back, I was clawing him for years, and then finally I just went out on my own, but then we went to the theater and we saw Jaws, and I was freaked out the rest of that summer.
I wouldn't worry about that. More likely to hit my life. Those are statistics. Sorry, what the heck?
remember watching Tex Antoine and Storm Field and thinking that was the coolest job in the world, too.
And it's beautiful. Underwater, like, cave made by the lava came up. And we're just swimming around one of these areas, and I saw a white-tipped reef shark kind of in the distance. And I had my camera with me. So I go swimming after the thing and try to take a picture, and it took off like lightning. They're afraid of us, you know. But I got a picture of it swimming away in the distance.
Yeah, I think it would be really neat if you posted some of those pictures. I would love to see it. I just like seeing stuff from back in the day anyway, you know, like, I like to see street scenes, old cars, people's clothes, stuff like that. You should post some of those old photos you have.
I'll do that. Maybe I'll scan a couple in now, but then I'd like to get that whole album, my mom's book album. It's not a huge one. Pictures of the shark. I wonder where that picture of that white reef shark came from Maui. Kept the pictures in boxes. A lot of them I have on slides, so I would have to transfer them. But my Montauk pictures are print. The lab had developed little dark rooms, so I used to develop my own black and white all the time there.
Of the black and white processing and printing. I had my own little lab set up in the bathroom. That was so cool. It was like magic. That's when I first picked up photography, was in high school, and as a freshman, and never looked back. And I would still love to process black and white, and I still love the way black and white images look.
First time I developed film, I must have been like 7, 8 years old. There was a camp in Mayville, Fidel's camp. Where we learned how to all the darkroom procedures in black and white. And we had these canisters with the little spiral pools inside. We would wind our film around there. And it was really good. It was a great experience. In college, I took a couple of graduate courses. In college, I took electron microscopy, both scanning and the transmission, which I loved. That was the field I was considering going into. And eventually I got my converted part of my parents' basement into a dark room. And I got myself this nice Bessler Nichrome color head. So I started doing a little color. Well, that was kind of rough. I ended up stopping it for a while. But developing these pictures and film was enjoyable, very enjoyable. And my daughter has an eye for photography. Oh, my Lord. Very, very unique prospective view that
you have. You should call up your, or have her contact local patch, patch.com. That's probably in your town. I know there's one in Westbury. And start, you know, getting her stuff published. Start getting her, you know, noticed.
Yeah, challenge with her. Transportation is one of the problems. We just have a license. But we would, my wife and I even did it yesterday, but we'd love to get her entitled to a photography program to really teach her how to do it. You know of any programs around? As a matter of fact, I thought of it yesterday. I said, why don't I have her tag along with Andy for a second?
Anytime. You know what? We go out most weekends going looking for this or that. My wife comes with me a lot. Just to tag along and to have fun, and she loves, you know, beachcombing and stuff. But anytime, we would bring her with us. She might feel a little awkward, like we're these strangers, but I'd be willing to, you know, or we could meet down there or something, you guys could come. But I just pulled into my parking lot, so I'm going to sign 7-3s, and hopefully we'll pick this up again later. I have to, actually have to go to the airport today, so I'll be on probably after 2 or so, and for a couple hours, depending on traffic, so maybe I'll, I don't know, you're working, so we'll catch you next time, but any time you want to try that, you know, we could do that.
Appreciate it very much. I wouldn't want to, hold you back or burden you with anything, but that's very nice. Thank you. I'll be back on the air at 5. couple minutes before 5. I'm going to escape from the office. I'm usually on for 45 minutes, so it'll probably be done by then. 83 SY will be clear and listening in. Have a good day, 73.
Okay, no, don't hold me back at all because a lot of times it's just casual. It's just for my own pleasure, and my wife and I just enjoy the walks and the drives and the conversations. So photography is just a big plus for it. Maybe it's an excuse to go. But yeah, I'll talk to you later, Andy. This is WA2PIX, and I'll be clear. 73.
73. And Julio, how are you?
Good morning, Ricardo. Good morning. Hopefully it's staying warm. Did you have snow down there in Massapequa Park this morning? We had a little dusting up in Jericho.
Same here, a little bit of dusting, 99% rain. And it rained like hell, like it was going to rain 40 days and 40 nights.
I remember that one. I think I was in high school. I don't remember what season this was, quite a while ago. So we actually had, if we didn't have actual rain, we had fog. As you can see, for 40 days this had occurred. That was the weirdest thing I've seen. Boy, this is the end, is it? I'm not done with high school yet.
I hope we don't get that today. You know, a lot of rain. It's a little overcast, but it's okay. And, nothing much going on here. I have my friend here. I consider him a friend. His name is Pierre. He's from Haiti. And, very nice fellow. He's taking care of me today. He comes here Monday to Friday. And, you know, he helped me with something the other day to fix a slide-out drawer that I keep the laptop on. It's very kind. I gave him a few bucks and we had Chinese food together. And he was a carpenter back in Haiti. You know, half the island is Haiti, the other half is the Dominican Republic. Every day he'd go across the border, Dominican Republic, he was carpenter.
Very good. That's a nice trade, carpentry. I've done some woodwork at home, you know, just trim work, fixing walls, putting a wall up, molding. I made those, what do you call those things? Not the waistcoat, the boxes of moldings you put in the wall, on the wall, make it look like it's really decorative. Woodworking is pretty cool. I know somebody who actually does it as a profession. He makes cabinets and, oh man, there's all kinds of stuff. Wall units. And the work that they do is amazing with the dovetailing in the theme. Incredible. You've got to have some skill to do that.
I didn't want to put it over the radio, so I have a little ice tea here. I drank that and settled it down. Anyway, let me ask you, a scuba diver? The reason I'm asking, you know my situation, you normally kick your legs. I know how to do it. I was a very good swimmer in high school. They were cut off, you know, above the knees. Do you think if I went to a pool, I could get along?
When I used to teach, there was an organization around that used to work with the handicapped scuba divers. I know it's been done. I don't know if this agency is still around. I don't remember what they're called. Might have been just a trench and a couple of people that were helping out. I don't know. But it's possible in the shallow water, obviously your arm getting in and out of the water, you're going to need help. The weight belt is heavy. It's a bit of a chore in your situation. It would be a bit of a chore. But it's doable. You really have a lot of restrictions.
time now. Do you think a float would help?
You don't want to float. You want to be neutral. That's the whole point. Becoming neutrally buoyant in the water, that you can do, it's no problem. Just getting around in and out of the water, the weight valve, the tank. Probably have to practice on cool side for a bit, so you can get what it's like.
No, you got me wrong. I don't want to scuba dive because you mentioned tanks. That's way out of my league. I just want to be able to go to a pool with a lifeguard and swim. I was very good in high school.
Oh, that's no problem, sure. As long as there's somebody to keep an eye on you. My brother was a paraplegic, and he used to go in the pool. My parents had a pool. So that's, no, absolutely you can do that.
And to Leo, I think there's a pool around here in Massapequa Park. When the weather gets better, I've been thinking about it last year, but I did nothing about it. I guess, like you said, I got to be helped in and out of the water. I guess a pool without a lifeguard, would they help me?
You have to call that place and ask. There may be a liability issue. If you have a friend that's with you, they certainly should be able to help you out. And I'm just pulling into my parking lot. Good time today. Rich, you have a good day. We'll catch you soon. KD2DSY, I will be here on your front. 73 Rich.
Andy, very good. Short chat, but a very nice one. You're always a nice guy that I like to talk to. You and Ed, you remember Ed? Comes on here in the morning, the afternoon. I call Mr. Ed after the TV show. See you later. KD2ESY. And Tubio is quick.
KD2ESY, 73 minutes.
In a Toyota was now 24 hours. Synthetic oil, 70 for an oil change.
God, yes, this is the price of these things going up. Now, I got a nice 98 Durango. It's got plenty of clearance in front of the motor. Pulling the shroud off, pull the belt off. Reach down and see what I can do about getting the actual pump out.
It's rare that the water pump breaks when you pull it out. It's all metal. At least it used to be all metal, you know. I don't make it plastic nowadays, everything, but they make it so crummy. But it's probably just a gasket, which is unusual that they go too. And nowadays, they got such great stuff on the market chemical-wise. I remember I had a Cougar, and I blew the head gasket. I mean, that's, you know, a lot of work. And my friend, oh, you go to the store, Walmart, where the Pet Boys, and pick up a little jar and stuff. I said, oh, well, what's that going to do? He said, well, it'll fix it. I said, you got to be kidding me. It's going to fix it? I doubt that. He said, well, for a couple of hours, isn't it worth a try? I put it in, it worked fine. I drove the car for a year and I sold it.
Yeah, they had this sort of thing called Ready Stop Leaks at one point in time. Let in. It stopped the leaks, but it also at one point in time stopped my heater core from running. The heater core must have been had this calcium buildup or whatever minerals get around it.
Well, the radiator you're talking about, which is a radiator, it's a little miniature radiator that goes inside the car. A lot of people have never even seen it, but it's a tiny radiator. And you have the glove boxes where they always seem to stick it. And you can change that too. But again, it's work, you know, it's just mechanical work. Yeah, a lot of people are afraid to attack it, so to speak. You know, you open the hood, you go, oh my God. And I remember opening the hoods on, you know, 1954, 50 Mercury's, and 58 Oldsmobile, and no matter what it was, you open, there's plenty of room, there's a motor, and there's all kinds of room everywhere. Now, the new cars, you open the hood, you go, how do I get to the spark plug? I don't even see the spark plug. So the whole secret is you got to know where it is before you take it apart. I'll get a service manual. In fact, I still have the car and the service manual. I remember traded in the 1960s.
68, I bought a new Corvette, and I traded the Corvette in 2 years later, worst car I ever had, and I bought a 1970 Plymouth Barracuda, 335 horse, 3-speed, 6, positive 410 rear, on 7 miles to the gallon. Still got the car, it's about 52,000 miles on the car. And, well, I lost my train of thought, so that, back to you.
November 2, Hotel Victor Romeo.
Hilton Annuals to my, my Ford.
Yeah, this is definitely true to the day. Six repair daily.
So those things are, so my truck's put together
a problem. Except for when I forget to put oil in it.
Okay, yeah, that was the thought, the service manual. Only, that's why I started to say 70 Plymouth, not a brain, got back into gear. And the service manual is, oh my God, it looks like a telephone book. It's so big, so thick. I think at the time it was something like $30, which is a lot of money in 1970 when I bought it, and it's been wonderful. And you know, you don't know where things are, and you want to fix something. It's got beautiful pictures, illustrations. I guess they still make, although nowadays everybody I talk to, nobody does any work on the car, like a millennial different environment. When I grew up, everybody worked on their car.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely old school. It's not that I don't believe in all the service things, is what they do, but I kind of enjoy being under the hood every once in a while. I'm a computer repair guy, a different thing to fix, different problems to diagnose, and different solutions to come up with.
Yeah, and it's just practical, too. It's like anything else, you know, you do it long enough. I remember one of the sons came over and popped the hood, and we diagnosed it, and I said, oh, oxygen sensor. You see, you think, sucker, oh, for sure, oxygen sensor. So I showed him where it was, take it out. It was a lot of money, it was like $50, I think. Put it in, that fixed it, he was all set to go. Another time was the map sensor. But they got all these sensors all over the car. I got a tool like they have, a little meter, and it tells you what sensor's been.
Yeah, you plug it into the ODI port, hit the scan button, it reads off the current code. Maybe clear them once in a while, so this way you get a current code list. But yeah, as you said, the computerized cars kind of, hopefully to the best of their ability, self-diagnose. And you just follow the instructions and say, hey, okay, replace this sensor, let's do that. And then you get things like where the transposition sensor is bad, you go and change it, and it still reads crank position sensor, so your car never starts again. What the hell? I had another Durango sitting in the driveway with a slight case of that.
Okay, very good. I never heard of that sensor. That one doesn't ring a bell. I got a bubble out of the car, so good luck fixing it up there. Thanks for chatting with me here. That's keeping me company. Thank you for the use of the repeater. WB2ROL, really out loud and Iceland. Bye bye.
Geo Chad, N2HVR.
LJC Center.
You have yourself a good day, and hopefully we'll catch you on the return trip. Geo Chad, N2HVR. Good morning, station. Name here is Nick, and the call is N2HVR. Just checking out a new mobile antenna. How are you hearing me?
Loud, clear. It sounds like you're sitting right next to the repeater. What's your GPH?
I'm in the mobile. I'm down in Broad Channel. I can see JFK Airport from here. Running 50 watts on 2 meters. Just trying out a new antenna. I got a Hustler dual bander from HRO. It's having some problems. I've worked the low Earth orbiting satellites. Couldn't get in for some reason, yet be fine. So I'm a little puzzled.
Well, right now you hit the repeater super strong, it sounds like, because I don't hear any static in your audio. And I'm not that far away from the repeater myself, but you can hear it centering. The repeater
buried over in Farmingdale or something like that. But yeah, no, it's a nice crystal clear signal here. So what, you got a search?